An Osho Talk. The Art of Dying. Talks on Hasidism. Number 9.
One day, after he had gone blind, Rabbi Bunim visited Rabbi Fischel. Rabbi Fischel was famous throughout the land for his miracle cures. "Entrust yourself to my care," said his host. "I shall restore your light." "That is not necessary," answered Bunim. "I see what I need to see."
Spirituality is not a question of morality. It is a question of vision. Spirituality is not practicing of the virtues, because if you practice a virtue, it is no more a virtue. A practiced virtue is a dead thing, a dead weight. Virtue is virtue only when it is spontaneous. Virtue is virtue only when it is natural, unpracticed. When it comes out of your vision, out of your awareness, out of your understanding. Ordinarily, religion is thought to be as a practice. It is not. That is one of the most fundamental misunderstandings about religion. You can practice non-violence, but you will still remain violent because your vision has not changed. You still carry the old eyes. A greedy person can practice sharing, but the greed will remain. Even the sharing will be corrupted by his greed. Because you cannot practice anything against your understanding, beyond your understanding. You cannot force your life into principles unless those principles are of your own experience. But so-called religious people try to practice virtue. That's why they are the most unvirtuous people on the earth. They try to practice love, and they are the most unloving people on the earth. They have created all sorts of mischief, wars, hatred, anger, enmity, murder. They practice friendship, but the friendship has not flowered on the earth. They go on talking about God, but they create more and more conflict in the name of God. A Christian is against the Mohammedan. The Mohammedan is against the Hindu. The Hindu is against the Jaina. The Jaina is against the Buddhist. That's all they have been doing. There are 300 religions, and they have all created fragments in human minds. They have not been an integrative force. They have not healed the wounds of human soul. Because of them, humanity is ill. Because of them, humanity is insane. And the insanity comes out of one thing that has to be understood. as deeply as possible, because you can also go in the wrong direction. The wrong direction has a tremendous appeal, otherwise so many people would not have gone on it. The appeal must be great. The magnetic force of the wrong direction has to be understood, only then you can avoid it. You can try practicing anything you like and you will remain opposite to it. You can enforce a sort of stillness upon yourself. You can sit silently. You can learn the yoga posture. You can put the body almost as if it is without any movement. You can make the body like a statue. And by repeating some mantra, or by just repressing the mind continuously for a long time, you can enforce a sort of stillness upon your being. But it will be the silence of the cemetery. It will not be throbbing, alive, kicking. It will be a frozen thing. You can deceive others, but you cannot deceive yourself, and you cannot deceive God. You have got it without any understanding. You forced it upon yourself. It is a practiced silence. The real silence arises out of the understanding. Why I am not silent? Why I go on creating tensions for myself? Why I go on getting into miserable patterns? Why I support my health? One starts understanding the why of one's health. By that very understanding, by and by, without any practicing on your part, you start dropping those wrong attitudes that create misery. Not that you drop them, simply they start disappearing. When understanding is there, things start changing around you. You will love, but you will no more be possessive. It is not love that creates trouble. Ask your so-called saints, they say it is love that creates trouble. It is absolutely a false statement. It is based on a deep misunderstanding of a human love life. It is not love that creates misery. Love is one of the greatest blessings, a benediction. It is possessiveness that creates misery. Possess your beloved, your friend, your child, and you will be in misery. And when you are in misery, those religious people are there waiting by the corner. They jump upon you. They say, we had told you before, never love. Otherwise you will be in trouble. Drop out of all love situations. Escape from the world. And of course it appeals because you are seeing it happening already to you. It is now your own experience that they are right. And still they are not right. And it is not your experience. Because you never analyzed the phenomenon that has happened. You never analyzed that it is not love that has tripped you into misery. It is possessiveness. Drop possessiveness, not love. If you drop love, of course the misery will disappear. Because by dropping love, you will be dropping possessiveness also. That will be automatically dropped. The misery will disappear, but you will never be happy. Go and see your saints, and what I am saying, they will be the proofs of it. They will never be happy. Yes, they are not unhappy, that's true. But they are not happy either. So what is the point? If happiness does not arise by dropping unhappiness, then some mistake has been committed. Otherwise, it should be natural. You say, I have lighted the candle and the darkness is still there. So either you are befooling yourself, or you are dreaming, hallucinating about the candle. Otherwise, it is not possible. The candle is burning bright and the darkness is still there. The darkness is a certain absolute proof that the light has not entered yet. When unhappiness drops, suddenly there is happiness. What is happiness? Absence of unhappiness is happiness. What is health? Absence of disease is health. When you are not unhappy, then how you can avoid happiness? When you are not unhappy, how you can manage not to be happy? It is impossible. It is not in the nature of things. It is against the arithmetic of life. When a person is not unhappy, suddenly all his sources are alive. A dance arises in his being. A joy arises in his being. A laughter bursts forth. He explodes. He becomes a Hasid, a Sufi. He becomes a presence of divine ecstasy. By seeing him, you will see God, a glimpse, a ray of light. By visiting him, you will be visiting a shrine, a sacred place, a Tirtha. Just by being in his presence, you will be suffused of a new light, a new being. A new wave will arise around you, and you can ride on that tidal wave, and you can go to the other source. Whenever there is really a dropping of unhappiness, happiness is left. Nothing else is possible. One is simply happy without any reason, without any why. But your sins are not happy. Your sins are very sad. Your sins are not living. Your sins are dead. What has happened? What calamity? What curse? A misstep. They thought love has to be dropped. Then there will be no misery. They have dropped love. But the misery was not coming because of love. The misery was coming because of possessiveness. Drop possessiveness. In fact, convert the energy that is involved in possessiveness into love energy. That cannot be done by enforcing anything. A clear vision is needed, a clarity. So the first thing I would like to say to you is, spirituality is not practicing of any virtue. Spirituality is gaining of a new vision. Virtue follows that vision. It comes on its own accord. It is a natural byproduct. When you start seeing, things start changing. In life, there are three things. One, the objective world, the world of things. Everybody is able to see that. We are naturally capable of seeing the objective world. But this is only the beginning of the journey. Many have stopped there. and they think they have arrived home. Of course, they have not arrived, so they are miserable. Beyond the objective is the opening of another world, the world of the subjective. The objective is the world of things, objects. The objective is the world of science, mathematics, physics, chemistry. The objective is very clear, because naturally we are born perfectly able to see the objective. The subjective has to be explored. Nobody is born with the vision of the subjective. The subjective has to be explored. One has to learn what it is. One has to taste it by and by and move into it by and by. The world of music, poetry, art, the world of any creativity is the world of the subjective. The man who starts moving inwards becomes more poetic, more aesthetic. He has a different aroma around him, a different aura. The scientist lives with the things. The poet lives with persons. The scientist is not at all aware who he is. He is simply aware about what surrounds him. He may be able to know about the moon and about the Mars and about the stars far, far away. But he is completely oblivious of his own inwardness. In fact, the more he becomes concerned with faraway things, the more and more he becomes oblivious of himself. He remains almost in a sort of sleep about himself. The poet, the painter, the dancer, the musician, they are closer home. They live in the subjective. They know they are persons. And when you know you are a person, suddenly you become capable of looking into persons. For a poet, even a tree is a person. Even animals are people. For a scientist, even a man, a woman, is nothing but an object. He looks at a man also as if he is just an object. He is not aware of his own inwardness, how he can be aware of the inwardness of the other. When I use the word person, I mean that there is an inside to it, which is not available to the outside observation, analysis, dissection. There is a rock, it has no inside. You can break it. You can see everywhere. If you break a rock, nothing is disturbed, nothing is destroyed. Even if it is in pieces, it is the same rock. But you break a person, something of tremendous value immediately disappears. Now you are left with a dead body. And the dead body is not the person. The rock broken is still the same rock, but a person broken is no more the same person. In fact, the person broken is not a person at all. On the dissection table of a surgeon, you are not a person. Only when a poet touches you and holds your hand, you become a person. That's why people hanker for love. The reason for the hankering for love is nothing but this, that you would like somebody to see that you are a person, not a thing. You go to the dentist, he is not worried about you. He is simply interested into your teeth. Even if I go to the dentist, I see him, what a miracle. He is not interested in me, he just looks. I am there, sitting in his chair. He is completely oblivious of me. A great space is available just in his room. But he will not look even at me. That's not his concern. He is only interested in the teeth, in his own technique. His knowledge of the objective world is his only world. People hanker for love because only love can make you a person. Only love can reveal your inwardness to you. Only love can make you feel that you are not just that which looks from the outside. You are something more. You are something totally different than you look. The reflection in the mirror is not your totality. The reflection in the mirror is just a reflection of your surface, not about your depth. It says nothing about your depth. When you come to a scientist or a person who is absolutely absorbed with the objective dimension, he looks at you as if you are just the reflection in the mirror. He does not look at you. He looks around you. His approach is not direct. His approach is not intimate. And you feel something is missing. He is mistreating you. Because he is not accepting your personality. He is treating you as if you are a thing. He is doing things, but he is not touching you at all. You remain almost non-existential to him. And unless somebody touches you with love, looks at you with love, your own inwardness remains unfulfilled, unrecognized. That's the need to be needed. The subjective is the dimension, inward dimension of poetry, song, dance, music, of art. It is better than the scientific because it is deeper. It is better than the objective because it is closer home. It is not yet the dimension of religion, remember. There are many people whose mind is obsessed with the objective. When they think about God, God also becomes an object. Then God is also outside. Ask a Christian, where is God? And he will look upwards. Somewhere in the sky, but outside. When you ask a person, where is God, and he looks somewhere else than within himself, then he belongs to the non-religious dimension. People ask, what is the proof of God? Proofs are needed only for a thing. God is not a proof, needs not a proof. If I love you, what is the proof? For poetry there is no proof. For chemistry there is. But poetry exists. And the world without chemistry will not be very much worse. But a world without poetry will not be a human world at all. Poetry brings meaning to life. The unproved brings meaning to life. The proved at the most makes you comfortable. God is not an object and cannot be proved. God is more like music. It exists. Certainly it exists. But there is no way to grab it. You cannot have it in your fist. You cannot lock it into your treasury. There is no way. Love exists, but you cannot purchase it. If you try to purchase, you belong to the objective dimension, and you are killing love. That's why possession is destructive. If you possess a woman, you say, she is my wife and I possess her, then she is no more a person. You have reduced her to be a thing, and she will never be able to forgive you. No wife has ever been able to forgive the husband. No husband has ever been able to forgive his wife, because both have reduced each other into things. A husband is a thing, a wife is a thing. And when you become a thing, you become ugly. You lose freedom, you lose inwardness, you lose poetry, you lose romance, you lose meaning. You become simply a thing in the world of things. Utility is there. But who lives for utility? Utility can never be satisfying. You are being used, how it can be satisfying? Whenever you feel you are being used, you feel offended, and you should feel offended, because it is a crime to use somebody, and it is a crime to allow somebody to use you. It is a crime against God. But there are people who try to use God also. When you go and you pray for something, you are trying to use God. You don't know what prayer is. You don't know what love is. You don't know what poetry is. You don't know the subjective realm at all. Your prayer, if it has a motivation in it, a desire in it, is ugly. But we find, we are very cunning people. We find ways and means. Let me tell you one anecdote. A minister, a priest and a rabbi were discussing how they divined what part of the collection money each retained for personal needs and what part was turned into their respective institutions. "I draw a line," said the minister, "on the floor. All the money I toss in the air. What lands to the right of the line I keep. To the left of the line is the Lord's." The priest nodded, saying, "My system is essentially the same, only I use a circle. What lands inside is mine, outside is his." The rabbi smiled and said, "I do the same thing. I toss all the money into the air, and whatever God grabs is his." We go on playing even tricks with God. In fact, God is also our invention. A very cunning invention. It is also somewhere there. You can pray to him. You can ask things from him. you can find security in him, consolation, comfort in him. It is a security measure, a sort of otherworldly bank balance. But it remains an object. God is not an object. That's why Mohammedans, Christians, Jews have all tried not to make any image of God. That's very symbolic and meaningful. Because when you make an image of God, it becomes objective. Let God remain without any image. But it has remained only in the theology. Whether you have made an image of God or not, it makes no difference. Your mind, if it is just capable of moving in the objective dimension, will treat God as an object. Even a Mohammedan turns for his prayers towards Mecca, that becomes the image. Even a Mohammedan goes to Mecca to kiss the stone, that becomes the image. The black stone of Mecca is the most kissed stone. In fact, it is very dangerous to kiss it now. Unhygienic. But whether you make an image of God or not, if the mind is objective, your idea of God will be objective. Suddenly when you think of God, you start thinking of high heaven, the uppermost boundary of the sky. There God is. For a truly religious person, if you ask where God is, he will close his eyes and go inwards. There God is. Here, inwards, your own being is divine. Unless God is immanent, unless God is immersed in your being, you are carrying an image. Whether you have made an image of wood or a stone does not matter. You can make an image with thinking, thought, idea. That too is an image of a subtler material, but is still an image. Man remains the same unless he changes his dimension. There is somebody who is an atheist who says there is no God. Because he says, I cannot see. Show me and I will believe. And someday he comes to have some experience, a vision, a dream, in which he sees God standing. And then he starts believing. In Gita, Arjuna, Krishna's disciple, goes on asking again and again, that you go on talking about him, but I cannot believe unless I see. Now what he is saying? He is saying, let God be objective, then I will believe. And Krishna concedes to his desire. I am not happy with it. Because to concede with this desire means to concede that the objective dimension is capable of knowing God. The story says, then Krishna revealed his reality, his vastness. He revealed God. Arjuna started trembling and shaking. He said, stop, enough, I have seen. Because he saw Krishna expanding and becoming the whole universe. And in Krishna, stars moving and sun rising and moon and planets and the beginning of the world and the end of the world and all life and all death. And it was too much, he could not bear it. He said, stop. And then he came to believe. But this belief does not change the object. This belief does not change the objective dimension. He was not believing because he could not see. Now he has seen, so he believes. But the God remains in the objective world. The God remains a thing. I'm not happy with Krishna that he did it. It should not be done. It is conceding to a foolish disciple's desire. The disciple needs to be changed from his dimension. He should be made more subjective. But we remain. We go on changing forms, but we remain the same. I have heard the funeral was over. Still sobbing, Goldberg, the new widower, followed his late wife, sister-in-law, into the waiting limousine. As the big car passed through the cemetery gates, the sister-in-law was horrified by Goldberg's hand, which was slowly but passionately creeping up her leg. Her body still, red with sobs of bereavement, she screamed, "Goldberg, you fiend, you monster, you animal, my sister is not yet cold in her grave. What is the matter with you?" In a voice shaking with emotion, Goldberg replied, "In my grief, do I know what I am doing?" People remain the same in their grief or in their other moods, they remain the same. Because the grief is yours, you don't change the dimension. So this is the first thing to understand, that you need a shift from the objective to the subjective. Meditate more and more with closed eyes about your emotions, about your thoughts. Look deeper into the inner world, the world that is absolutely private to you. The objective is public, the subjective is private. You cannot invite anybody into your dreams. It is not possible. You cannot say to your friend that tonight come into my dream. Because the dream is absolutely yours. You cannot even invite your beloved, who may be sleeping just on the same bed, and just by the side of her, hand in hand you may be sleeping. But you dream your dreams, she dreams her dreams. Dreams are private. The subjective is the private. The objective is the public. The objective is the marketplace. So many people can watch one thing, but so many people cannot watch one thought, only one person. The person to whom the thought belongs can watch it. Remove your consciousness more and more to the private. The poet lives a private life. The politician lives a public life. Mahatma Gandhi used to say that I don't have any private life. That means he must have had a very poor life. A private life is a rich life. The politician's life, it's just there to be watched by everybody on the TV, in the newspaper, on the streets, in the crowds. The politician has only a public face. When he goes home, he is nobody. He loses all face. You have to find out your private face. The emphasis should be more on the private than on the public. And you should start learning how to love the private. Because the private is the door to God. The public is the door to science, but not to religion, not to God. The public is the door towards arithmetic, calculation. But it is not the door to ecstasy, to love. And enjoy things which are very private. Music, poetry, painting. Hence the insistence of Zen on calligraphy, painting, poetry, gardening. Something that is absolutely private. Something that you live from the in towards the out. That rises as a wave in the innermost core of your being and spreads outwards. The public life is just the reverse. Something rises outside and fades into you. In a public life, the original, the source is always out. Your center of being is never within yourself. It is always outside. That's why a politician is always afraid of the outside. Because his life depends on the outside. If the people don't vote, he will be nobody. But that doesn't make any difference to a painter or to a poet. Nobody purchased Vincent van Gogh's painting. In his whole life, not a single painting was sold. But that doesn't matter. He enjoyed. If they are sold, good. If they are not sold, good. The real prize is not in their being sold and appreciated. The real prize is when they are being created by the painter. In that very creation, he has attained his goal. The moment of creation, he becomes divine. You become God whenever you create. You have heard it said again and again, God created the world. I say you one thing more. Whenever you create something, you become a small God in your own right. If God is the creator, then to be creative is the only way to reach him. Then you become participants. Then you are no more a spectator. Van Gogh, appreciated or not, lived a tremendously beautiful life in his inner world, very colorful. The real prize is not when a painting is sold and critics appreciate all over the world. That is just a booby prize. The real prize is when the painter is creating it. When the painter is lost in his painting. When the dancer has dissolved into his dance. When a singer has forgotten who he is and only the song throbs. There is the real prize. There is the real attainment. In the outside world, you depend on others. In the public life, in the political life, you depend on others. You are a slave. In the private life, you start becoming a master of your own. Let me insist and emphasize it, because I would like all of my sannyasins to be creative in some way. Because to me, creativity is of tremendous import. An uncreative person is not a religious person at all. I'm not saying that you have to become all Van Goghs. You cannot. I'm not saying that you have to become all Leonardo da Vinci, or Beethoven, or Mozart, I'm not saying that you all have to become Wegeners and Picassos, Rabindranath. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that you have to become a world famous painter or poet, or you have to win a Nobel Prize. Because if you have that idea, again you fall into politics. The Nobel Prize comes from the outside. It is a booby prize. It is not a real prize. The real prize comes from inwards. And I am not saying that you are capable, all are not capable of becoming Picassos. And there is no need either. Because too many Picassos will make a very monotonous world. It is good that there is only one Picasso. And it is good that he is never repeated. Otherwise it will become boring. But you all can become creators in your own ways. It does not matter whether anybody comes to know about it or not. That is absolutely unimportant. You can do something out of love. It becomes creation. You can enjoy something while you are doing it. It becomes creative. Now I am talking to you, and Astha is cleaning my bathroom and my room. I inquired her, would she like to drop this work and come to the talk? She said, cleaning your bathroom is enough for me. It is a creative act. And she has chosen it out of love. And certainly she is not missing anything. Whether she listens to me or not is not the point. If she loves cleaning the bathroom, if she loves me, it is a prayer. You may listen me, you may not listen me. You can sit here. She is not here, but she has listened to me. She has understood me. Now the work itself becomes worship. Then it is creative. To all of my sannyasins, I would like it to be reminded again and again that be creative. In the past, the majority of religious people proved uncreative. That was a calamity, a curse. Saints were simply sitting doing nothing. That is not real religion. When real religion explodes into people's life, suddenly much creativity explodes also. When Buddha was here, a great creativity exploded. You can find proofs in Ajanta, Ellora. When Tantra was a alive religion, a great creativity exploded. You can go to Puri, Konarak, Khajuraho. When Zen masters were alive, they created really many new dimensions out of small things, but very creative. The question is, that if you are uncreative, that simply means you must have practiced your religion. You must have forced yourself into a certain pattern. And you have got blocked, frozen into that pattern. A religious person is flowing, streaming, river-like. Seeking, exploring, always seeking and exploring into the unknown. Always dropping the known and going into the unknown. Always choosing the unknown for the known. Sacrificing the known for the unknown. And always ready. A religious man is a wanderer, a vagabond. Into the innermost world, he goes on wandering. moving from one place to another. He wants to know all the spaces that are involved in his being. Be more creative. Dance. And don't bother whether somebody likes your dance or not. That is not the question. If you can get dissolved into it, you are a dancer. Write poetry. No need even to show to anybody. If you enjoy, write it and burn it. Play on your flute or guitar or sitar. You must see our tabla player Bodhi. How meditatively he plays on his tabla. That's his meditation. He is growing, going into it, dissolving, melting. The subjective is the realm of all art and creativity. These are the two ordinarily chosen realms of being. The third, the really religious, is the transcendental. First is objective. The objective is the world of science. Second is subjective. The subjective is the world of art. And third is the transcendental. That which goes beyond both is neither objective nor subjective. Is neither out nor in. In which both are implied. In which both are involved, but yet it is higher than both, bigger than both, beyond the both. The subjective is closer to the transcendental than the objective. But remember, just by being subjective, you don't become religious. You have taken a step towards being religious. A very important step. But just by being subjective, you don't become religious. You can find poets who are not religious. You can find painters who are not religious. Religion is more than art, more than science. What is this third? First, you start looking into your thoughts. Drop the public world and move into the private. Look into your dreams, your thoughts, your desires, your emotions, your moods, and the climates that go on changing inside you. Year in, year out, look into it. This is the subjective. Then the last and the ultimate jump. Then by looking by and by into thoughts, start looking into the looker, the witness. One who is watching the thoughts. First move from things to thoughts and from thoughts to thinkers. Things is the world of science, thoughts is the world of art, and the thinker is the world of religion. Just go on moving inwards. The first circumference around you is of things. The second is of thoughts. And the third, the center, your very being, is nothing but consciousness. It is nothing but a witnessing. Drop things, go into thoughts, then one day thoughts also have to be dropped. And then you are left alone in your purity. Then you are left absolutely alone. In that aloneness is God. In that aloneness is liberation, moksha. In that aloneness is nirvana. In that aloneness, for the first time, you are in the real. The objective and subjective are divided. There is a duality, a conflict, a struggle, a division. The person who is objective will miss something. He will miss the subjective. And the person who is subjective will miss something. He will miss the objective. Both will be incomplete. The scientist and the poet both are incomplete. Only the holy man is complete. Only the holy man is whole. And because he is whole, I call him holy. I don't mean by holy that he is virtuous. I mean by holy that he is whole. Nothing is left. Everything is involved. His richness is whole. The subjective and the objective both have dissolved into him. But he is not just the total of subjective and the objective. He is more. The objective is without, the subjective is within, and the religious is beyond. The beyond comprehends both without and within, and yet is beyond. This vision is what I call spirituality, the vision of the beyond. Few more things. In the world of the objective, action is very important. One has to be active, because only action is relevant into the world of things. If you do something, only then you can have more things. If you do something, only then you can change in the world of the objectivity. In the world of subjectivity, inaction, doing is not important. Feeling. That's why poets become lazy. And painters, even great painters and great poets and great singers, they have bouts of activity. And then they relapse again into laziness. The subjective is more sleepy, dreamy, lazy. The objective is active, obsessed with action. The objective person needs always to do something or other. He cannot sit alone. He cannot rest. He can fall asleep, but once he is awake, he has to do something. The subjective person is inactive. It is very difficult for him to move into action. He enjoys the world of fantasy, and that is available without action. He is not to go anywhere. He has just to close his eyes, and the world of dreams opens. The religious person is a meeting of the opposites. Action in inaction. Inaction in action. He does things, but he does them in such a way that he never becomes the doer. He remains a vehicle of God, a passage. Wei Wei, what the Chinese call. Inaction in action. Even if he is doing, he is not doing it. His doing is very playful. There is no tension in it, no anxiety, no obsession about it. And even when he is inactive, he is not dull. Even when he is sitting, are lying down and resting, he is full of energy. He is not in a lethargy. He is radiant with energy. Because both the opposites have come to a meeting and to a higher synthesis in him, he can act as if he is not doing, and he can remain in a non-doing state, but still you can feel the energy. You can feel the vibe of tremendous activity around his being. Wherever he moves, he brings life to people. Just by his presence, dead people become alive. Just by his touch, dead people are called back to life. Exactly the same as when Lazarus died and Jesus was called. And he went to the grave where he was kept. And Jesus called out, "Lazarus, come out!" And the dead Lazarus came out. And he said, "I am here. You called me out of death. I am here." A religious person is active not because he is a doer. A religious person is active because he has infinite energy available. A religious person is active not because he has to do something, he has any obsession to do. Not because he cannot relax, but because he is such a pool of energy that he has to overflow. The energy is too much and he cannot contain it. So while sitting silently, you can see Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, but you will see energy playing around him. A great aura of energy. It is said a beautiful story about Mahavir, that wherever he will move, for miles together, life will become more alive. And he was an inactive man. He will simply stand under a tree for hours or for days, or sit under a tree for days, but for miles, life will start throbbing with a new rhythm. It is said, trees will bloom out of season. Trees will start growing faster than ever. Dead trees will start producing new fresh leaves. Whether it happened or not, that is not the point. It may be just a story, but it is very indicative. It is very symbolic. Myths are not historic things. Myths are very meaningful symbols. They say something. What this myth says, it simply says, Mahavir is such a pool of energy. Such overflowing of energy, such overflowing of God, that wherever he is, life will move faster. There will come a speed to all existence around him. He will not be doing anything, but things will start happening. Lao Tzu has said that the greatest religious person never does anything, but millions of things happen through him. He is never a doer, but much happens through him. He simply goes on sitting. And yet, tremendous is the impact of his being on the world of affairs. Nobody may come ever to know about him. He may be sitting in a cave in the Himalayas, and you will never know about him, but still your life will be affected because he will be vibrating a new energy, a new pulse he will give to life, a new pulsation he will impart to life. You may not come to know about him, but you may have been benefited by him. The opposites become complementaries in a religious being. The day and night meet and dissolve their conflict. The man and woman meet in the religious person and dissolve their conflict. A religious person is Ardhanarishwar. He is half man, half woman. He is both. He is as strong as any man can be, and he is as fragile as any woman can be. He is as fragile as a flower, and as strong as a sword. He is harsh, and he is soft, and he is both together. He is a miracle. He is a mystery. Because opposites meet, he goes beyond logic. His being is paradoxical. He is alive as nobody else is alive, and he is dead, more dead than the dead who are in the graveyards. He is dead in a way and alive in a way, together, simultaneously. He has known the art of dying and the art of death simultaneously. In ordinary life, with ordinary mind, everything is divided into its opposites. And there is a great attraction to meet with the opposite, the man seeking the woman, the woman seeking the man. The yin-yang circle. In a religious man, all search has stopped. The man has found the woman has found the man. In his innermost core, the energy has come to a point where everything has dissolved into oneness, into non-duality, advaita. All opposites become complementaries. All conflicts dissolve and become cooperation. Then you have come home. Then there is no need to go anywhere. Then there is nothing to be sought, nothing to be desired. This state is the state of God. God is a state. God is not an object, and God is not even a person, because God is neither objective nor subjective. God is transcendental. If you are in the objective, I will say seek the subjective. There is God. If you are in the subjective, I will say now go beyond. There is no God in the subjective. God is beyond. By and by, one has to go on eliminating. By and by, one has to go on dropping. God is when there is no object and no subject, when there is no thing and no thought, when there is no this world and no that world, when there is no matter and no mind, God is. God is neither matter nor mind. In God, both edges. God is a tremendous paradox, absolutely illogical. Beyond logic. You cannot make an image of God in wood, in stone. And you cannot make an image of God in concepts and ideas. When you dissolve all images, then that which is left, when you have dissolved all, in, out, man, woman, life, death, all dualities, then that which is left is God. Now this is story. One day, after he had gone blind, Rabbi Bunam visited Rabbi Fishel. Rabbi Fishel was famous throughout the land for his miracle cures. "Entrust yourself to my care," said his host. I shall restore your light. That is not necessary, answered Bunam. I see what I need to see. The eyes that see only outside are blind. They are not really eyes yet. They are very primitive, rudimentary. The eyes that see within words are more real. The rabbi was right. He said, now there is no need to restore my eyes. Because objects I cannot see now, but I don't want to see them in the first place. And the one that I need to see, I can see. It is good that blindness has happened to me. Now I am no more disturbed and distracted by the world of the objects. It has happened many times. Milton became blind. And all his great poetry was born only when he became blind. First, he was very much shocked. Naturally, he lost his eyes, and there was no way to restore them. He thought his whole life is finished. He was a good poet, already famous. And of course, a poet thinks without eyes, how can you see the trees and how can you see the moon and how can you see the river and the wild ocean? And without eyes, how can you see the colors of life? Of course, your poetry will become very poor. It will lose colors. But Milton was wrong. He was a religious man. He accepted his blindness. He says, okay, if God wills it that way, then that has to be so. He accepted it. And by and by he became aware of an infinite new world available, the world of the inner thoughts. He became subjective. Now there was no need to see outside, so the whole energy was available. Have you seen blind people? On their faces you will always find a certain grace. Even ordinary blind people look very graceful, very silent. They don't have any distraction of the outside world. Scientists say that man lives through the eyes almost 80% of his life is involved with the eyes. 80%. Only 20% is distributed to other senses. 80% you live through the eyes. That's why when you see a blind man, a great compassion arises in your being. You don't feel that much compassion for a dumb, for a deaf. No. But for a blind person, great compassion arises. You feel, poor fellow. 80% of his life is not there. Eyes are very important. The whole scientific search depends on the eyes. Have you ever heard of any scientist who was blind? It is impossible. A blind person cannot be in objective research. It becomes difficult. But there have been many blind musicians, blind singers. In fact, a blind person has tremendous qualities of the ear, which a man with eyes cannot have. Because his 80% energy is no more being wasted by the eyes. That energy shifts to his ears. his ears become very, very receptive and sensitive. He starts seeing through the ears. Hold a blind man's hand and you will be surprised. You will find a very alive touch which you will not find in people who have eyes. Hold the hand of a blind man and you will feel a warmth flowing towards you, because the blind man cannot see you. He can touch you. His whole energy moves into his touch. Ordinarily, you touch by your eyes. A beautiful woman passes by. You look. You have touched her. Through the eyes. You touched her whole body. And without offending her. And breaking no law. By and by, you forget completely what touch is. Eyes have become monopolies. They have taken many energies from many sources. For example, the nose. Eyes are very close to nose. The eyes have taken the whole energy from the nose. People don't smell. They have lost their smell power. Their noses are dead. A blind person smells. His smell capacity is tremendous. When you come too close to him, he knows your smell. He recognizes you by your smell. He touches you. He knows you by your touch. He hears your sound. He knows you by your sound. His other senses become alive. And he is very graceful, because eyes create much tension. When Milton became blind, first he was shocked, but then he accepted. He was a religious man. He prayed to God and he said, "Thy will be done." By and by, he was surprised that it was not a curse, it was a blessing. He became aware of infinite colors inside. It was a psychedelic world. Very subtle nuances, very beautiful dreams started opening to him. And all his great poetry was born. When he became blind, he was a good poet, but not a great poet. When he became blind, he was no more a good poet, he became a great poet. And a good poetry is just so-so, lukewarm. Maybe you cannot find any fault in it, but that's all. A great poet has a penetrating energy in it. A great poet is a revolutionary force. It has an impact to shake the whole world, to change the whole world. It has happened many times. When a person has become suddenly blind, if he can accept it, that very acceptance gives him a new world. The objective disappears, the subjective opens its door. And subjective is closer to the transcendental. That's why all the meditators close their eyes. Have you observed? All women close their eyes when you make love to them. Men never close their eyes. They are foolish. Man wants to see the woman when he is making love to her. He would like to have the light on, so he can see. And there are many foolish people who will have mirrors in their bedroom. Not only they would like to see the woman, they would like to see all the reflections around. And there are few who have fixed cameras in their room. Automatic taking pictures, because if they miss something right now, later on They can see it. But women are still not that foolish. I don't know about liberation women. Maybe they are doing the same, because they have to compete with everything, whatsoever it is. They may be making love with open eyes, but then they will miss something. Man makes love in the objective dimension. Women make love in the subjective. Women immediately close their eyes, because it is so beautiful inside. What is there to see outside? When you are moving in love energy, melting, flowing, and an orgasm happening inside you, it is there that reality has to be looked at. The man is just foolish, he is just looking at the body. The woman is more understanding, she is looking at the psyche, a higher standpoint, but is still not religious, artistic, aesthetic, is still not religious. When you become religious, then arises the tantra attitude. Then you don't see with open eyes, you don't see with closed eyes, you simply see the seer. You are not worried about the experienced. You look in the experiencer. You look in the witness. Then love becomes tantra. Whether it is man or woman who is moving into the dimension of tantra, he or she is not interested what is happening, rather more interested in this witness who is watching it all. Who is this witness? And when the energy is exploding in such a natural, spontaneous realm, it is better to watch. Just be a watcher on the hills. Forget about your being a man or a woman. Forget about your being in the body. Forget that you are a mind. Just be a witness, and then you have become transcendental. Tantra is transcendental. And this dimension has to be evolved into all your ordinary life situations. Whatsoever you do, you can do in three ways. Objective, that is the scientific way. The Western way. Or the subjective, the Eastern way. Or the religious way, the transcendental way, in which each East and West meet and dissolve. The religious way is neither Eastern nor Western. The West is scientific, the East is poetic. The West thinks in terms of history, the East thinks in terms of myths and Puranas. The West is most concerned about what reality is. The East is most concerned about the fantasy about the reality, the dream about the reality. The West is concerned more with the conscious mind. The East is concerned more with the unconscious mind. But religion is beyond both. The religion is of the superconscious mind, the transcendental mind. It is neither Eastern nor Western. Just like as man and woman meet, East and West meet. West is more male, East is more female. West is more will, East is more surrender. But religion is beyond and both. That is not necessary, answered Bunam. I see what I need to see. Certainly a great religious statement. That's enough, more than enough, if you can see the seer. If you can be your consciousness, your awareness, that's enough. All is available. You have become a god. Nothing else is needed. strive for that state of being. If you are coming from the West, struggle for it. If you are coming from the East, surrender for it. If you are coming from the West, will for it. If you are coming from the East, be passive. Wait for it. And if you are Mahasannyasins who don't belong to the East or to the West, then drop all duality. Be non-dual. Then drop all division. Then just be indivisible. If you belong to me, then you belong to the transcendental. That is the whole meaning of being initiated by me. I bring you the transcendental. I bring you the ultimate. I bring you that which cannot be seen in the outside, that which cannot be seen in the inside, but you can become that because you are already that. Enough for today.